Undersong is such an evocative poem. It's about the sounds that you can hear in the rainforest. And in my piece, you can hear all those little sounds, the sounds of the crickets, the sounds of the birds, the sounds of the distant jaguar, and the drops of rain. And that's what I wanted to evoke in my setting of the text. Undersong. There is music in the strong, deep-throated bush. Whisperings of song heard in the leaves' hush. Ballads of the trees in tongues unknown. A reminiscent tone on minor keys. My name is Sean Doherty. I'm an assistant professor in music at Dublin City University. I came across Lulla Ridge when I was living in the Coombe. It must have been about 2011, 2012. And I was casting around for an Irish poet whose words I could set to music for choral forces. So I was looking through lots of anthologies of Irish poets. And I came across this one poet, Lulla Ridge, who I'd never heard before. Then I discovered that she was born just a stone's throw away in Meath Place. Well, it was called Coal Alley. So I couldn't believe this amazing piece of luck. So I looked into her work, read her biography, and found out that she was an incredible character in her own right. She was an anarchist, radical feminist, very politically active, as well as an amazing poet. So I thought, I really have to explore this in my music.
When Lulla Ridge died in 1941, she was described in the New York Times as one of the leading poets of America. Her work blazed a trail for many of today's politically engaged poets, both in Ireland and internationally, who are writing about issues of race, the plight of migrants, and social injustice. For many years, she was largely forgotten, but in recent times, her work is being rediscovered. And like composer Sean Doherty, who's been inspired to set her poems to music, poet and novelist Therese Faboda was also immediately engaged by her story when she came across it.
I had never heard of her until 2011 when I came across Robert Pinsky's article in Slate. It was called Street Poet, and I was so excited that in the comments section, where you're supposed to be staid and learned, at least for Robert Pinsky, I had several lines of exclamation points and many vowels of excitement.
In fact, Therese was so taken with Lola's story and so impressed by her work that she spent several years researching her life and poetry and went on to publish her biography of Lulla Ridge, Anything That Burns You. Lulla Ridge lived for many years in the United States and before that in Australia and New Zealand, but she started life in Ireland.
Lulla Ridge was born in 1873 in Dublin. Her parents were from Galway and her mother was an older mother, and she separated from the father very early on in Lola's life, and that caused Lola to be very close with her mother.
Mother, your love was like moonlight, turning harsh things to beauty, so that little wry souls reflecting each other obliquely, as in cracked mirrors, beheld in your luminous spirit their own reflection, transfigured as in a shining stream, and loved you for what they are not. You are less an image in my mind than a lustre. I see you in gleams, pale as starlight on a grey wall, evanescent as the reflection of a white swan shimmering in broken water.
Lulla was only 4 years old when her mother took her off to Australia, and she was never to return to Ireland. Her mother had a sister there, but they got little support from her and lived in poverty. After a few years in Australia, Lola Ridge and her mother moved to New Zealand, where her mother declared herself a widow.
Lola's mother married a miner shortly after she arrived, and he wasn't terribly successful, and so it was a rough life, and they lived in a tiny little town not too far from Hokitika on the South Island. Lola wasn't terribly fond of her father. They committed him to a madhouse when she was about 18. I think she was about 21. So he must have been a difficult man.
One evening, as she was doing her homework, and she could hear the water in the creek outside, the sight of her stepfather sitting staring into the fire inspired Lola Ridge to write her first poem, although it was her mother who recognised that what she had written actually was a poem.
And Lola exclaimed that she saw then that she could be a poet.
She later regretted not keeping that first poem, but something had been sparked and she continued to write. She was 18 when she had her first poem published in the Canterbury Times.
Afar in the mists of the future, a shadowy nation I see. Her cities are girded by forests, her shores are caressed by the sea. Nation, your watchword, the north winds cry, the waves lashing the shore. And the forests reply what the south wind repeats, half a song, half a sigh, on Zealanda.
Her first poem was On Zealanda, which was a nationalist poem extolling the virtues of New Zealand and also bringing forward the miners' rights.
Her son shall toil at that furnace where the fuel is thoughts and deeds, and follow the heroes of ages where the light of their glory leads. Injustice shall fall by the sword of the brave, with the fetters of class in an honourless grave. O'er the runes, let freedom and brotherhood wave on Zealanda.
It just showed that Lola's interest in progressive politics began with her upbringing in New Zealand and continued on with her practice of anarchy and liberal ideas for the rest of her life.
Like her mother had done, Lola married a miner. He was Peter Webster, and he was much more financially successful than her stepfather. In 1896, they had their first child, who died at just 2 weeks. And then in 1900, she had a second child, Keith, who survived. But Lola was frustrated by life in the back of beyond in New Zealand, and leaving her husband behind, went with her mother and her young son to Australia, where she studied art and began to publish in Australian magazines. And while she had some success there, within a few years, she looked further afield. And what she did next echoed what she herself had experienced in her childhood.
Well, Lola's mother had taken her at the age of 4 from Dublin on the long voyage to Australia and then on to New Zealand, leaving behind her husband. Lola, 20 years later, did really the same thing. She had a young son about the age of 7 that she set off from Australia to San Francisco in a very similar way. I mean, her mother had just died, her stepfather was dead, and she'd left behind her husband in New Zealand.
There were both personal and political reasons underpinning her decision to move to the US.
This is Lucy Collins, Associate Professor in the School of English, Drama and Film at University College Dublin.
The personal ties keeping her in Australia and New Zealand were gone. And at the same time, of course, she is very attuned to politics, particularly class and labour politics. And of course, in America at the time, there is a ferment, in a sense, around industrialisation, modernisation, especially in the urban environments. So while we don't have any clear kind of documentation of why she chose to go to America, it does seem to be this combination of personal and political drive, I guess, that sent her there.
Lola Ridge used a false name and lied about her age, not for the first or last time, as she sought to reinvent herself and create a new life.
First of all, on a very practical level, because she had lived in New Zealand and Australia from a child, she had family there, so she had a network of people who knew her origins, knew her background. Whereas going to America, she knew nobody there, so in a sense, she could start afresh. And I think for someone like Ridge, who was very ideologically driven, very ambitious, but also aspirational, not for herself, but for a better society, I think it was very attractive that she could go to a new place and make a fresh start.
When Lola arrived in California, she spent a couple of months in San Francisco, and then she went down to Los Angeles and put her son in an orphanage.
Which today we might think of as an appalling thing to do.
Well, I think certainly at that time there was a slightly more fluid sense of the parental relationship and the relationship between mother and child. So we today might judge that more harshly than at the time. I think as well she was a single mother. She had to make a living. She was probably aware of the difficulty of that, of sustaining her maternal role in that context. But also she did stay in touch with her son, and she did visit her son as well for a period of time. And so it wasn't that they were completely estranged.
And at the time, orphanages were also a place where if you were having a bad patch financially, you would drop your child off and then pick them up later. So it wasn't as outrageous a move as you would think.
And it freed her up to pursue her career as a poet.
She moved alone to New York, and there she effectively dropped a decade of her age and reinvented herself as a poet, as an activist, and very much part of that anarchist movement in New York.
The ghetto. As I sit in my little fifth floor room, bare save for bed and chair, and coppery stains left by seeping rains on the low ceiling and green plaster walls, where when night falls, golden ladybugs come out of their holes and roaches sepia brown consort. I hear bells pealing out of the grey church at Rutgers Street, holding its high-flung cross above the ghetto, and one floor down across the court, the parrot screaming, "Vorwärts! Vorwärts!"
Lola Ridge's first book was published in 1918, called The Ghetto and Other Poems. It made a spectacular splash in the literary scene. It was on the cover of the four-year-old New Republic, along with H.G. Wells and so forth. And she got lots of press because she treated the immigrants as people and not as the difficult characters that had been portrayed by Eliot and Henry James.
With all respect to Henry James, his pages about the Lower East Side are abominably anti-Semitic.
This is Robert Pinsky, former Poet Laureate Consultant in Poetry to the Library of Congress, and author of the article on Lola Ridge, which first got Therese Faboda interested in her life and work.
He talks about how degenerate and destroyed the English language is here, and the beautiful American idea here, it's being decayed by these, he says, I can't quote it exactly, but basically these big-nosed fish are devouring everything. And he wasn't as well-equipped as Lola Ridge to look at the Lower East Side sympathetically.
She portrays the Jewish people in this collection as very industrious, very anxious to learn the language and the customs of their newly adopted homeland, politically aware, sophisticated people who were trying very hard to make their way into American life.
Here an old gray scholar stands, his brooding eyes that hold long vistas without end of caravans and trees and roads and cities dwindling in remembrance, bend mostly on his tapes and thread. What if they tweak his beard, these raw young seeds of Israel, who have no backward vision in their eyes? and mock him as he sways above the sunken arches of his feet. They find no peg to hang their taunts upon. His soul is like a rock that bears a front worn smooth by the coarse friction of the sea. And unperturbed, he keeps his bitter peace. What of a rigid arm and stuffed blue shape, backed by a nickel star, does prod him on, taking his proud patience for humility? All gutters are as one to that old race that has been thrust from off the curbstones of the world. And he smiles with the pale irony of one who holds the wisdom of the Talmud stored away in his mind's lavender.
The last poem in her first book, which must have been written after the Irish Easter Rebellion in 1916, memorializes her distance from her Irish past.
Well, The Tidings is one of a number of poems that Ridge wrote about Easter 1916 and about the revolutionary period in Ireland. I think to our eyes now, the poem could be linked to, indeed, to Yeats's Easter 1916, although it's unclear how much Ridge engaged with the literary production of Ireland during those years. But one thing we notice from the poem in particular is the emotional approach she takes to events in Ireland. And so she talks about her heart as like a rousing bell. You know, she speaks not necessarily from a sort of political or ideological perspective, but very much from a personal, emotional perspective.
The Tidings, Easter 1916. Censored lies that mimic truth. Censored truth as pale as fear. My heart is like a rousing bell, and but the dead to hear. My heart is like a mother bird, circling ever higher, and the nest tree rimmed about by a forest fire. My heart is like a lover foiled by a broken stair. They are fighting tonight in Sackville Street, and I am not there.
I think her Irishness was very important to her. I think it was definitely reignited by the events of 1916 and the subsequent years. She's certainly described as an Irish poet very often in her biographies at the time when she was writing. And there are a number of images and ideas that come through the work, even work that is not focusing very explicitly on the Irish context. So, for example, the figure of Kevin Barry appears in her work. And there, I think it's this emblem of youth and of solidarity, you know, the singular figure in solidarity with a wider community that Ridge really wants to invoke.
Lola published her second book only 2 years after her first. The title poem, Sunup, was written in the voice of a little girl living in Australasia. She's a bad little girl, and no one else for the next 50 years portrayed such a character in poetry so vibrantly and in the voice of a child. I'll read a little excerpt from that poem, which those of you who have ever tortured a Barbie will relate to. I beat Janie and beat her, but still she smiled. So I scratched her between the eyes with a pin. Now she doesn't love me anymore. She scowls and scowls, though I begged her to forgive me and poured sugar in the hole at the back of her head.
Elsewhere in the poem, the child marvels at the stars, and these lines again attracted composer Sean Doherty.
I wanted to reflect the meditative, quiet, reflective quality of the text.
Thank you.
It's strange about stars. You have to be still when they look at you. They push your song inside of you with their song. Their long, silvery rays sink into you, but do not hurt. It is good to feel them resting on you like great white birds. And their shining whiteness doesn't burn like the sun. It washes all over you and makes you feel cleaner than water. And then to build up to a huge crescendo where she talks about the sun, being burned by the sun, and how that's not the case when you look at the stars. And then the light of the stars washes over you and makes you feel cleaner than water. It's a kind of almost a baptismal image. It's a purifying image.
In her second collection from 1920, Sun Up and Other Poems, she again also looks to Ireland in her poetry, and this time she focuses on the figure of Jim Larkin.
It's not surprising, I think, that she would choose Jim Larkin as the focus for a poem like that, a poem of Irish attention in particular. It's interesting, though, that she chooses to depict Larkin as this larger-than-life heroic figure, but almost like a ghostly figure, a figure kind of striding the streets while ordinary men and women are getting on with their lives. And it's a way of writing, I think, that Ridge used again and again to signify the idea of the single historical figure as making a really important intervention in Irish history and in world history, in having a huge impact beyond perhaps their own immediate life. And so I think she was aware of Jim Larkin as one of those figures. He was, of course, also an international figure in many ways too. And so it appealed to her sense of socialism as breaking those boundaries of nation.
To Larkin. Is it you I see go by the window, Jim Larkin? You not looking at me nor anyone, and your shadow swaying from east to west? Strange that you should be walking free, You shut down without light, and your legs tied up with a knot of iron. 100 million men and women go inevitably about their affairs in the somnolent way of men before a great drunkenness. They do not see you go by their windows, Jim Larkin, with your eyes bloody as the sunset and your shadow gaunt upon the sky. You and the like of you, that life is crushing for their frantic whines.
Lola Ridge was a familiar and striking figure in the New York poetry world in the early decades of the 20th century.
Lola wore her hair parted down the middle and pulled back in a bun, the way Virginia Woolf was, and she had the long aquiline nose and a solemn expression nearly always in her photographs. A contemporary described Lola as being slender, tall, soft-speaking, and thin-featured. Tall is interesting because in her picture with Edna St. Vincent Millay, she was the same size, and that meant she had to be under 5 foot tall. She must have emanated her height.
But tall or not, she became central to the poetry scene.
Whenever Lola published her own poems, she gave a party, and everyone came because she was the fulcrum of modernism at the time. She was friends with William Carlos Williams, Marianne Moore, Hart Crane, and tutor to Jean Toomer, the Black Renaissance poet. She had such influence that both E.E. Cummings and Pound consulted her for her opinion of the literary scene.
Lola Ridge is a very important figure in bringing together the political and the aesthetic dimensions of modernism, because we know that modernism had a strong political dimension. It was very much driven by political change and events. But many of the poets we associate most strongly with modernism were not necessarily political activists or politically engaged directly, whereas we know that Ridge was. And we know that because of her interest in activism and in anarchism, because in particular of her engagement with immigrant communities and the idea that art should be paying attention to the lives of the ordinary people, as well as to the higher intellectual pursuits. The coming together of those two elements makes her in many ways the quintessential modernist.
And in the 30s, when Lola was interviewed by an English critic about what were the appropriate topics for an artist to attend to, she replied, "Anything that burns you." And that was her creed. She really did not censor herself when it came to something that was important.
One issue that Lola Ridge turned her attention to was the practice of electrocution. It was introduced as a new form of capital punishment in 1917. Here's poet Sarah Clancy.
The poem Electrocution, it's a sonnet, and it's an extremely striking piece of work because although it's quite a crafted poem for Lola Ridge, a lot of hers are very free verse, and it seems to use imagery that could come from the pastoral or it could come from her, you know, describing a landscape, but she's actually describing the moment of electrocution of a man. She's also describing the executioners as monstrous deaf dolls, and it really hits into you, you know, the actual moment of the execution. And you know, you couldn't hear this poem and not picture an execution, but also picture the consequences of an execution. And I think that's a real power of her poetry. You know, she has everything in it. She has the fact that an execution doesn't just happen, that somebody does it. The second thing, that the person who's being executed has a whole history and a life. And in a few short lines, she manages to get that. You know, he's looking back at where he was from. And then she ends in the terrible catastrophe where he's arched and, as she says, expanding in white agony. And it has to have been an extremely striking piece of work at the time. I know that that very first year that electrocution was introduced, that 45 people were executed that year. And so it was a real talking point. And I think Lola Ridge had such celebrity in that era that for her to write a poem like this, it was, yes, it was brave and yes, it was daring, but it was a really important thing to do, you know, because a poem could pass from one person to another, as many of hers did, and just create that picture of what an actual electrocution was. And I think, you know, I think that it must have been extremely powerful in its time.
Electrocution. He shudders, feeling on the shaved spot the probing wind that stabs him to a thought of storm-drenched fields in a white foam of light, and roads of his hill town that leap to sight like threads of tortured silver, while the guards, monstrous, deft dolls that move as on a string, in wanted haste to finish with this thing, turned faces blanker than asphalted yards. They heard the shriek that tore out of its sheath, but as a feeble moan, yet dared not breathe, who stared there at him, arching like a tree, when the winds wrench it and the earth holds tight, whose soul expanding in white agony had fused in flaming circuit with the night.
In 1927, Lola Ridge was involved in a campaign to prevent the execution of Sacco and Vanzetti, two Italian immigrants who had been falsely accused of murder. Poets and writers demonstrated outside the prison in Boston where they were being held, and coverage of the event shows that she had now become a public figure.
Her name was featured on the front of newspapers across the country. It gives you an idea of the prestige and influence that writers had then.
But prestige didn't prevent her being arrested.
She was subsequently arrested by the authorities there, along with Edna St. Vincent Millay, and there is a little film clip and a still showing the two of them, these two tiny little women, being dragged off by a burly policeman.
But while that protest was unsuccessful, and the executions of Sacco and Vanzetti went ahead, she continued to protest against injustice and to believe in the power of poetry. And one occasion when a poem had a practical, direct impact was in the case of Tom Mooney.
Tom Mooney was of Irish heritage. He was born in Chicago and he was a long-term labour activist. He had joined the Socialist Party of America and lived in San Francisco. He was jailed in 1916 after being convicted of involvement in a bombing at a demonstration. The conviction was unsafe, and so there was a long campaign to free him from prison. And she wrote this poem, Stone Face, about him.
They have carved you into a stone face, Tom Mooney. You there lifted high in California, over the salt wash of the Pacific. And your eyes crying in many tongues, goading innumerable eyes of the multitudes, holding in them all hopes, fears, persecutions.
That poem was enlarged and put on placards and hung in labor organizations all across the country. In fact, it was probably the most read poem ever of any New Zealander in America. It's just an odd kind of notoriety. But she did feel that her poetry could make a difference, and he was, in the end, released from prison.
While Lola Ridge was carving out her career as a poet, her son Keith continued to live in an orphanage, and they were not reunited until he was 14. But there was no happy ending.
She and her boyfriend at the time, David Lawson, whom she would marry in a few years, traveled with him all around the Middle States and New Orleans, and then left him in Detroit when he was 17 and never saw him again.
It's interesting that she didn't write about her son, but we know that the idea of their estrangement and the sense of what she had done by leaving him, I think, did clearly affect her. There are some letters in which she wrote about dreaming about him and the effects of those dreams on her mood and, you know, on her sense of self and so on. So it's not as though it was an episode of her life that she put behind her, but it was clearly a difficult decision that she made.
The separation between the mother and son was referred to obliquely throughout Lola's work. It permeated particularly her book called Firehead, which is ostensibly about the crucifixion and the terrible situation of Sacco and Vanzetti. But the underlying emotional content, since it's narrated by Mary, the mother of Jesus, is one of anguish at a lost son.
I did not love him as a mother should have loved such a son. I know this now.
When Lola died in 1941, right before America entered World War II, the newspapers, in particular the New York Times, said that she was one of our foremost poets. But she was forgotten almost immediately because of the pressures of the war years and then subsequently the McCarthy era, which was very anti-radical, and in literature was anti-experiment, and in terms of gender roles was very anti-female.
One of the things that we're most interested in now is her transnationalism, is the fact that she is Irish-born, you know, she participates in a literary culture in Australia and New Zealand, and then is identified essentially as an American poet. She writes about immigrant communities, and that, of course, is fascinating to us today. But in the intervening period, I think, it has meant she does not squarely belong to any particular tradition. You know, she's not unproblematically Irish, neither is she unproblematically American. And I think that has meant it's more difficult to teach her, it's more difficult to read her work. And that, in a sense, I think, has made her marginal to, I suppose, a history of women poets in the 20th century.
But in recent years, the work of women poets has come to the fore, and the work of earlier poets has been rediscovered, including that of Lola Ridge. Sarah Clancy again.
Like many others, I only came across Lola Ridge quite recently, I'd say maybe 2 years ago at this stage. But it was a remarkable discovery for me. And, it, you know, as a writer myself and as someone who is involved in political issues, in a way it was a confidence booster discovering her, not necessarily because of her poetry and form, but because of her apparent complete belief in the fact that it's not the view of the critics that matter, it's your own view of what's happening at the time that you need to be writing. You know, the famous quote from her that you should be writing anything that burns you. And I think that one of the most devastating poems I've ever read is her poem Lullaby, which would be as topical today in Trump's America as it was at the time. Now, it uses really language that would be considered extremely racist today, but I think that it's worth taking into account that what she's doing is she's writing a really unpopular and uncomfortable position on race riots, where a mob of white workers who felt they had been disenfranchised by African Americans went on a rampage, killing African Americans who had been used as strike breakers. They had been manipulated. And while a lot of her political work would have been supportive of the union, she was very famously involved in a lot of campaigns. When she saw this, she wrote this poem, which really is the sharpest critique you could imagine of the conduct of the white rioters on that time against the African Americans. So she's created a monster in the poem. You'll see when you hear it, but she's created a monster. But the monster that she's created is one that happened. There was a story of a baby having been burned by white women, an African American baby having been thrown on a fire. And this lullaby tells that story. It really is devastating to listen to.
Lullaby. Rack-a-bye baby, woolly and brown. There's a shout at the door in a big red light. Little corn baby, mommy is down. Hands that hold you are steady and white. Look, Piccaninny, such a grand blaze. Licking up the roof and the sticks of home. Ever seen the like in all your days? Can you sleep, my bit of honeycomb? Rock-a-bye baby, up to the sky. Look at the cherries drifting by. Bright red cherries spilled on the ground, piping hot cherries and nuttin' a pound. Hush, my little black bug, don't you weep. Daddy's run away and mommy's in a heap. By her own front door in the blazing heat, out of the shacks like warts on the street. In the singing flame, in the gleeful crowd, circling around, won't mommy be proud? with a stone at her head and a stone on her heart and her mouth like a red plum broken apart. See where the blue and khaki prance, adding brave colors to the dance. About the big bonfire white folks make such grand doings for a little coon's sake. Hear all the eager feet running in town. See all the willing hands reach out at night. Hands that are wonderful, steady and white to toss up a little babe blinking and brown. Rockabye, baby, higher and higher. Mommy is sleeping and daddy's run lame. Sound may you sleep in your cradle of fire. Rockabye, baby, hushed in the flame.
So many of the themes and preoccupations in the poetry of Lola Ridge have a contemporary resonance, which make her a model for poets today. And she also continues to attract the attention of today's composers. Sean Doherty found himself turning again to her work just a few years ago.
I set her piece Snow Dance for the Dead for choir in 2017 for the centenary of the October Revolution. And this is a heart-wrenching piece. It's her response to the October Revolution and the Red Terror. And in it, she contrasts the innocence of young children dancing in the snow to the bloodshed of the war going on around her. So I took a few words from the much longer poem, "Dance, little children, to the rhythm of the snow." And I combined that with the callous euphemism used by the Cheka. That's the forerunners of the KGB, who used the word "not so cal" when they wanted to refer to someone being killed. And that's an onomatopoeic word. It's the sound of a gun being cocked and shot. "Not so cal." My ambition in the future is to set many, many more pieces of Lola Ridge. She's a wonderful, wonderful poet whose words just beg to be set to music.
Her work is fascinating from a formal point of view. It is engaging, it is lively, it is iconographically rich. It's very sensory, it's very vivid. And yet it's also intellectual, it's also very rich from a critical point of view.
There's lots to admire in it poetically, you know, and particularly in comparison to some of her peers, some of her male peers who are feted world over. But really, there's an extreme integrity in her poetry.
Lola's contribution to poetry is in her intense focus on social justice. And it's very timely that she and her work be remembered today.
And that was the New Dublin Voices, conducted by Bernie Sherlock, performing Sean Doherty's setting of Snow Dance for the Dead, ending that programme about the life and work of the poet Lola Ridge. We also heard Sean's setting of Undersong, performed by the Mornington Singers, conducted by Orla Flanagan, and It's Strange About Stars, performed by the Leitare Vocal Ensemble, conducted by Roisin Blunny, with soloists Dorina Johnson, Alan Duff, Niall Hayes and Jane Kelly. The contributors to the programme were Sean Doherty, Lola Ridge's biographer Therese Svoboda, poet Sarah Clancy, Lucy Collins of the School of English in University College Dublin, and Robert Pinsky, former consultant in poetry to the Library of Congress. Lola Ridge's poems were read by Kathy Belton. The programme was presented and produced by Claire Cunningham, and sound supervision was by Tin Pot Productions.